However, the judge is going to decide it. He needs to realize that this is not a slam dunk case in that sense, that there's really two forms here. There's the internet, and then there's the proprietary computer system. And the analogy I draw is that it's like me standing in the middle of a public park, pointing the megaphone at Intel, and Intel's in. Yes, you could say, well, media's going into their boardroom. Just as easily, you could flip that and say, yeah, but Intel's coming out of their boardroom and trying to go into the public park and stopping Hamidi from sending out his message. So you can kind of look at it either way. So what I think it really comes down to is I don't think either analogy is a slam dunk winner. What I think it is, like I said, it's like a balancing game. And I think that's how Pruneyard and all the other cases that the Supreme Court has looked at in this area, they all come down to a balance. No one analogy is going to be a knockout winner. So again, it has to be a balance. And that's why the facts of the case are really important, because then that weighs in the balance. And I think on this particular case, I'm pretty convinced that it weighs in favor of the speech.
Is there a case in which, suppose Intel was successful in eliminating or shutting off the ability of this person to send? Would they be within their rights, or would they be violating his free speech rights?
That's a great question, and that opens up a whole other part of the paper, which is, just briefly, this was an easier case to argue because what Intel is arguing for here is an injunction. And in that sense, I argue that there's state action. And Hamidi has no constitutional right to invoke unless it can prove that it's being abridged by state actors, by someone in the government. There's the state action requirement, obviously, in the Constitution. You know, if Jane tries to shut me up, or vice versa, I don't have any sort of constitutional claim against her because she's just doing it as a private individual. So Intel, in a sense, has a right to try to block this guy. So this is a good... I'm sorry.
No, let's just push it a little bit further. You suggested, or this man suggested, that his employees say, I don't want to hear it anymore. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. I appreciate it enormously. Then they have a right to do that. He cannot sue them.
Right. They have received it.
They have a right to do that, and the employer who has not only ownership of the property and not only ownership of the computers, but also some interest in morale interest in the whole operation. Why wouldn't the employer have a right to say, I don't want to hear that anymore?
Well, I think just talking about the interest of the employee, I think Hamidi would probably say, as long as the employee has heard my message once, as long as the employee has the opportunity to make his or her own judgment about whether they want to listen to this message, that's better than just shutting me up completely and just muzzling me and not letting me have send my message out at all. But then getting to your point about the employer itself, that is a complication in the case that I don't thoroughly address. That is another very interesting part of the case. But there are actually some California statutes that are also involved in the case that talk about labor law type of things that you bring up that I did not focus on. I just focused on sort of speech right and the property right. There's also the statutory, California statutory labor laws that have to do with it. And also, I believe that Hamidi relies on some right to picket, which would also go towards your employer analogy, where you can sort of say, well, if you bring in the employer analogy, maybe Intel has a better argument, and maybe again, Hamidi might also have a better argument too, because you can analogize his emails as the cyberspace equivalent of physical space picketing. I don't really go down that road really for space constraints, but I think it's a really interesting part of the case, and I hope that eventually the case does reach those issues, and I think it will.
It's interesting too, just from my perspective of like where how what we assume about cyberspace right now would be like to me would be part of the background of norms of how many email addresses does someone have. For example, if Intel allows their employees to do a lot of internet access, and you know, I start to use my Harvard address as my primary one. I don't really need to go get sort of another outside address, because I just want allows me to do everything I need to do. And I think it's interesting to see what the presumptions are. Do people have a home mailbox and a work one? It just made me think of those cases where there's whether it's a First Amendment right to put something into the teacher's mailboxes at school. And of course, maybe no, but you always can mail them at home, I mean, if you really have to. Whereas in this case, if you, I mean, people try to rely on one email address, one identity. I talk about this in my piece a bit, how you like to generate your own personality over time, and people know what they're going to get when they do K Hartnett at law. And you don't want to start to, and you kind of develop a personality around that name. And yeah, I can imagine if it's a world we live in which we each have our different addresses in different places, that would be a different world than one where the workplace networks are the way where we come to rely upon to get our email access. If that were to be the model we would have, then I think you'd have a lot stronger case for if you're going to email me, you're going to have to get me here because there's no other mailbox I have. I wonder if
that's... I mean, that's one of the really fun things I think about thinking about cyberspace is like making the right analogy, and this discussion is like making me think of other analogies. Like if you make the analogy to just regular old, you know, paper mail, I think Intel would say that, well, we have no right. If you're going to say the media just wrote all this stuff out on a postcard and you sent it to Intel, well, Intel would say, well, we have no obligation to take this postcard and deliver it to an employee's desk and make this person read it. That's probably true, but then Hamidi can come back and say, well, you also wouldn't have the right to interfere with the delivery of the U.S. mail and not allow these postcards to even get to your mailroom in the basement, which is really what Intel is doing in a sense. They're just saying, you know, we're going to block everything off, and this is not going to reach our computer system at all. So these analogies are helpful, and it's fascinating to think about them, but at a certain point, you just get stuck, and you have to come up with something. Somehow you got to resolve things in sort of a new way. So,
you know, I'm confused by your description of it. It's not that Intel is trying to stop me on their own. Like they just can't effectively filter. If they could effectively filter, Hamidi wouldn't have a claim against them.
Hamidi would not have a claim against them, according to, at least by traditional state action doctrine. Correct. Yes. So Intel's asking the court to do this, which is what it is very different. But I think you can also make this is sort of going a little more far afield. But if this weren't a case that involved an injunction, I still think you might be able to make an argument for state action here, or at least for arguing that maybe the courts, when they're looking at cyberspace, should go in a different direction in their state action doctrine. And without getting too detailed about it, basically, I think it has to do with the idea that law in cyberspace is really, to borrow Professor Lessig's term, is really dictated by code. It's dictated by what you can do with your computer system, what Intel can do, or what the media can do, just in terms of like the software of the internet. That sort of determines people's rights, and that's actually part of our Devo. Another author who couldn't join us today writes about code-based solutions to problems in cyberspace. And you could argue that the question of state action should not rise and fall on like the vagaries of whether or not Intel can successfully block Hamidi's speech. It shouldn't be this idea that there's state action or there's not, depending on how good Intel is at blocking things or how good the media is at getting things through. Instead, we should look at the underlying substantive right. We should look at his speech claim here and put it on the scale again and balance things. So that's a much harder argument to make, I think, and I think doctrinally it's a real loser. I don't think any court would look at, for example, America Online, if they terminated your subscription agreement or blocked your messages and wouldn't let you post the message you wanted to post on one of their like electronic discussion forums. I don't think anybody could march into court and say, you know, you violated my personal rights because AOL is a state actor. Maybe years from now, once cyberspace becomes such a prevalent part of our lives, and once this idea of like code being the law, catches on, if it does catch on, I think it is catching on. Maybe you can make an argument then, but right now, Yeah, I think it's just that it's a slam dunk loser. So, and this case doesn't have that problem because Intel's bringing an injunction. It's kind of a long-winded way of answering that.
With that was my good transition. We haven't heard from two people up there. I haven't about that. The chance to present their arguments. Maybe, Steve, you're talking about how we're going to structure organizations that will structure code. Maybe, I guess, sure.
My topic is the domain name system, specifically, well, broadly internet governance, and specifically the domain name system, because it's a good example of the overhaul of the domain name system that's recently happened and is still going on. It's a good example of internet governance issue today. And coming into this project, I'm sure I knew less than half as much as most anyone in this room. I really didn't know very much, and it was a top project to undertake because it's unfolding all the time, so I was constantly reading, online meeting sources and reading the transcripts, the minutes of the meetings of ICANN, and reading the white paper, reading all of the organizational documents and policy proposals. And what I found when I was reading it is some underlying theme, and that theme was that there are really some norms that developed in the internet, and people kept bringing them up, whether it's people like Mike Roberts, the interim CEO of ICANN, or just individuals who are coming to these meetings and voicing their opinions. And they kept saying things like, we need consensus, we need trust, we need accountability, we need bottom-up coordination. These were like buzzwords that I kept hearing. And I'm thinking, okay, there's something to this. And I sort of developed my thesis around what I heard from the different voices at these meetings and in these proposals. And my thesis is pretty much, it's just that in order to make internet governance more successful, I'm not saying that the domain name system will fall apart if everyone forgets about these norms, but in order to make it as successful as possible, I think it's important that that the structures of these new, the new domain name system pay attention to these underlying norms of consensus building, grassroots participation, issues like that. And in sort of building this thesis, I relied a lot on the work of Robert Ellison, Order Without Law. And in Order Without Law, Ellison talks about cases like Den v. Rich, cases where courts in structuring the law relied upon the established norms and customs of individual communities. And it's almost as if the internet has its own norms, its own customs. And in order for a new governance structure to work most efficiently, it would be great for that structure to encompass and to respect those norms that have built up around the internet. And as I came up with this thesis and I presented it to my advisor, Jonathan Vitrain, he had a major objection to it, which was a really powerful objection that I felt like I needed to address, straight up, and that's that the internet is growing. These individuals who started the internet, when it was an academic and resource-oriented body, I mean, there's just a few of the many millions of users now, and billions of users, and the commercial interests that are now much more powerful than they were, when the internet was just, ARPANET, and what was going on back in the 70s and even the early 80s. So, why will these customs still be important today? And my answer to that objection is, even though there are only, a small body of these sort of old-time participants, the sort of founding fathers of the internet, they created a culture that will continue to be spread throughout the larger internet because they're still in positions of power. If you look at the people who are on the board of ICANN, they have their roots in the old internet, in the original internet, and somehow that culture is ingrained in them, and I feel like they will somehow spread that, spread that throughout. And those people will feel more comfortable in an environment that they were sort of familiar with. And so I feel these norms will continue to be powerful. And I mean, that's sort of like what they're doing is creating a new domain name system. It's like creating a domain name system. It's like creating a new system of governance from scratch. And when was it done before? Well, a long time ago, it was done right here in the United States. We the founding fathers, who were a group of white men, all from the same background, created the culture, the Declaration of Independence, all of the things, the sort of buzzwords that are in our head today, egalitarianism, liberty, all of the things we hear today, are still part of us, even though now our country is so much bigger, it's so much more diverse. I mean, women have been in power, people of color have been in power. It's a much more diverse and different and bigger society than it once was, but we still share a lot of the same cultural values. And that's sort of the analogy that I made to the domain name system. Even though there are only a few individuals who are sort of rooted in the old internet, that culture might be so powerful that it will continue to spread throughout the system as the system of users and of commercial interests gets bigger and bigger. So throughout my paper, I went through the history of the internet and of how these norms were developed. I looked at the problems that that the current or that just recently passed domain name system had, the trademark issues and the customer service complaints that centered around NSI, and then looked at the solutions that have been proposed and that are being implemented to these particular problems, and really saw and have argued that a lot of the solutions that work are the ones that respect these indigenous internet norms, right up through, you know, the most recent meetings of ICANN.
I have a question there. Do the norms themselves scale? And as more people are working in the internet governance area, can they communicate in the same way that the original group of scientists and engineers could communicate?
Well, Allison has an answer for that. His piece of Order Without Law, based on a study done in Shasta County, California, among ranchers, among a really small community. And he said, though, that he didn't need to have done this study in a small community. The community doesn't need to be small. It needs to have really quick and open methods of communication. And the internet has that. Even though the internet is large, you can communicate with people across the world instantaneously. So in that sense, even with a large community of numbers, it could be sort of construed as a small community in terms of speed.
Some of the people who are moving on to the internet aren't in the same mold of communicating, instead of by email and getting an email and responding and having a transaction take place in 30 seconds. And I'm wondering whether, having worked in it and watched a lot of people have difficulty scaling the model, I'm wondering whether you have suggestions on how that would be implemented.
In terms of suggestions, I'm not really sure. I only know a lot of the new users are children, and in terms of, like, you know, they pick things up really, really quickly, and I think, you know, as soon as they see a new norm, just the way in school they learn to be, you know, sort of indoctrinated with our system of governance, a democratic system, a system of governance, it's easily to sort of absorb the same kinds of internet norms if they're presented to them in that way. That's the only sort of
My question would be, how do you, in some ways, when you have children in the school, you're able to enforce norms on them. When you're on the internet, it's where you want to go.
Right.
So how do you implement a norm on society that's self-selecting?
That's a good point. Because a lot of the support for my thesis had to come from parts of the internet that won't necessarily be the major parts in the future, like the mugs and the moots. There were ways to sanction users who did not follow netiquette in some way. But that is going to be much more difficult to do in the future. And that's why my thesis is modest. That's why I can't say, and if these norms aren't respected, the internet's going to fall apart, or they have to be respected. It's only that possibly by respecting these norms, that might grease the wheels of this larger internet society and help it work better, but it's not necessarily sort of a panacea to all the future problems that will come about.
You touched upon all the idea of people grabbing domain names and holding hostage as a problem with that.
Yes, that was one of the, you know, has been one of the major problems under NSI, their dispute resolution policy. It was first they didn't have a policy, and then when they finally did have a policy, it still registered domain names on a first-come, first-served basis so that people could take a domain name that related to someone else's trademark or that someone else was about to register and use it against that company or hold it hostage for money. But the white paper proposes, you know, a different way of dealing with trademarks such that trademarks would have to comport with domain names. The domain names would have to comport with federally registered trademarks up front, issues like that. Hopefully, you know, these are things that ICANN wasn't forced to deal with, you know, at the beginning. These are things that it will have to deal with, you know, from here on in. So I'm like hopeful that what the white paper proposes will be followed, but I mean, it's hard to say.
Well, that's an interesting point, because you are making the overall argument that the existing norms that came out of this more Lone Ranger culture of the old internet are things we should carry forward into the future. But then you're saying we should take this legal construction of trademark, which many have said is antithetical to the old norms of the old internet, and carry that forward. So, which is it, the old or the new, and if the answer is different things at different times, what principle by which you decide?
Well, the answer is the old and the new, but when the new comes in, it's hard to have. I think that people were opposed to NFS getting the trademark because NFS was brought in by NSF without the sort of consensus that came about in the creation of ICANN. I feel that, you know, the white paper that, I know you're on the last
page. I'm for PR.
But I think that, you know, the white paper proposal of, you know, compared to the green paper was really accepted much more readily. And the proposals that are in the white paper, I think if they come from the voice of the internet community as a whole, it'll be more readily accepted than coming from NSI, you know, from what people would view as a corporation that's sort of apart from the sort of indigenous element.
Would you like room around in Pandora's box?
Every innovation creates some destruction of the old, and that's the fact. We don't stop innovation because of that. Trademark owners are hurt, no doubt about it. That's because of the innovation, because of the clock. So maybe what the answer is, it's not that the norms of this. It's simply that it's a destructive place. And the answer would be what is being tried now is to find to reduce the harm without killing the internet, because it's quite clear that trademark interests are antithetical to the internet. They want no extension, as little extension as possible. We want, or the internet wants more.
It's hard to say, you know, who is the internet. I mean, probably looking at numbers of users, the people who want, or even moneyed interests, the people who want trademarks are possibly more powerful than the people who would be sort of fearful of trademark expansion on the internet.
Well, notwithstanding their power, first of all, they are not uniform. You know, one arm of AT&T may worry about trademarks. The other arm can't wait for a further extension. So that is another aspect of it. But as far as even that arm is concerned, there's a recognition that the internet is a good thing and should be encouraged.
Let's hang on to that for a moment and hear from Bob.
Yeah. Well, I sort of took a separate path. I actually didn't do, I wasn't advised to do the Burton thing. But I appreciate you all letting me come and share my paper.
Oh, we know that.
Yeah. But this will be fine. Yeah.
That's just when you can't eat any of the goldfish and
forget any of the final choice. Now among people know what they're
asking for.
Well, my advisor actually was Anne Marie Slaughter, who is in.
Who is affiliated with the Burton Center, so yes, we will be taking right.
Oh, she is affiliated with the Burton Center, yes.
Oh,
well. But at any rate, my topic was is cyberspace sovereignty, or actually more
properly as cyberspace and the discourse of state sovereignty. I try to focus on what's become sort of a theme in discussions about cyberspace, which is this concept of sovereignty. Actually, I'll read some interesting quotes. One of them actually is a member or fellow of the Berkman Center, John Perry Barlow, stated that states have no sovereignty where they gather, and that the governments of the world need to stay away from cyberspace. I think you are familiar with that. It's kind of an insightful quote I found in the looking through the legislative history of some of the Internet Acts, which seem to be increasing each year. Representative Goodlate, I believe his name, stated that the ability of a World Wide Web to penetrate every home and community across the globe has both positive and negative implications. While it can be an invaluable source of information and means of communication, it can also override community values and standards, subjecting them to whatever more may or may not be found online. In short, the Internet is a challenge to the sovereignty of civilized communities, states, and nations to decide what is appropriate and decent behavior. There's actually countless examples. China has prosecuted several of its citizens for various Internet-related activities under the crime of subversion of state sovereignty. It's a very nebulous concept, but very few people actually got it to really see what it means, particularly in the context of the Internet. Which on its face, its international or transnational validity, appears to be sort of undermining the concept of any sort of border territorial state. Well, basically, my argument proceeds in three stages. First stage, basically, looks at this these commentaries and this discourse of cyberspace or state sovereignty in the context of the Internet, and I analyze and I try to understand what it is they mean by sovereignty. The second step then sort of proceeds. Basically, my conclusion is that however you look at sovereignty, it's completely indeterminate, often circular, and that it's really, if we want to understand the relationship between the Internet and this entity that we call the state, it's necessary to view the state in a very different manner. And I draw upon some theories of international relations to sort of devise my own theory. Then, having done that, I then apply it to an area, a doctrine which is heavily influenced with notions of sovereignty, and that's personal jurisdiction. And I try to sort of come up with a unified approach to personal jurisdiction and resolve some of the debate which has been going on about whether accessing a website constitutes sufficient contact with a foreign state to merit a court's exercise of jurisdiction. So, returning to the first part, basically, looking at the commentaries, I think you can find sort of three general concepts of what they mean by sovereignty. The first concept is when people talk about sort of that the Internet is undermining the state or the sovereign state, many people are referring to what's known in international politics as the realist concept. Hans Morgenthau, people familiar with international politics, is proponent of this idea of the state basically extends the borders and no further, and that the world politics consists of sort of these billiard balls of states sort of knocking against each other, trying to aggregate themselves to the extent possible. It's all about power, and that if whatever takes place inside those borders is legitimate, that's state action. So it doesn't matter whether China, whatever human rights violations they might have within their own territory, that's their sovereign nation, whereas, that's just the realist concept. So in that sense, the Internet seems to undermine it in the sense that China doesn't know how to control. It seems to be that despite these people who reside within their territory, they're able to access content which is prohibited under sort of notions of Chinese sovereignty. So that's sort of the first concept, the realist concept. It's rather interesting, though, because promoters of cyberspace sovereignty or people of self-regulation paint cyberspace in sort of a territorial notion. They at once say that the Internet is undermining the concept of state sovereignty. And on the other hand, they try to create this concept of cyberspace as a sovereign territory. And the metaphors used in the discussions are rather interesting. I mean, this concept of cyberspace itself is really interesting because most people try to, when they talk about cyberspace, they talk about it as sort of the singular entity, but they often then change
their tone quite quickly to refer to the numerous communities which exist and how that, you know, people have, you know, multiple identities and how there's many communities out there. And so it's interesting to note that cyberspace has actually withstood sort of attempts to use a term such as cyberspaces, which is more accurately reflect sort of the notion of this place. Again, the concept of place is referring to the idea of territory. It's sort of this notion of this territorial state is very ingrained, and people trying to get governments to defer to cyberspace seem to constantly refer again to this, creating an idea of a bordered land called cyberspace. But anyway, the second concept of sovereignty that comes up is sort of what might be called the representational concept. And the second quote that I refer to refers to that in the sense that sovereignty is that which comes from below. It's the idea that a government represents the people, that the sovereign people are those who determine all for themselves. And the internet sort of undermines that because people like Britain, people in Missouri can then control what people in California see, even though people in California have voted that they don't want to see that. It's sort of, actually, it's mostly these people in California controlling what people in Missouri see. Then the third concept of sovereignty, which I think is quite common, is what might be called the postmodern conception of sovereignty. And that concept kind of, it basically refers to the idea that the sovereign state is just a social construct that exists. It, to the extent that there was this idea of the territorial state, it deteriorated. Notions of authority have dispersed into subnational organizations and transnational organizations, so that institutions such as Greenpeace might, for instance, be conceived of as its own sort of sovereign entity. And in this sense, then, it feeds a lot of the commentaries about cyberspace sovereignty, because the idea is that if you have a group who are bound together by interests, that is a much more legitimate. They're the ones who can determine their conduct, and that governments should respect their norms because they have their own type of this sovereignty, which the authority is dispersed to the people themselves, and that's sort of the concept of sovereignty that I guess this rule of thought refers to. And basically, again, it's sort of the reason that these concepts, it's difficult to go into a short period of time, how these concepts are definitely circular, but my proposal is basically that regardless of how you look at the territorial or the sovereign state, governments are regulating the internet. They're doing so at an increasing rate. So it is important to understand that to the extent we recognize this idea of the state, it's necessary to see how it relates to the internet. And so drawing on what's called global international relations theory, and a separate theory called constructivist theory, I try to propose this concept of state, which basically proposes that the state, as we call it, the state is basically, I'll take one step back. Liberal international relations theory has three basic assumptions. The first assumption is that the state represents groups. And it could represent, for instance, the Saddam Hussein, or it could represent the American public. And that basically what happens is that groups represent, that the groups represent various interests, and that the, I actually didn't make this a point. Okay. I'll just basically say that the idea of the state that I'm proposing is one in which the state is marked up by. I apologize.
Is ICANN a sovereign, and is Intel a sovereign?
No. Under I don't think that under any theory, Intel would be a sovereign. There would be people who would say that ICANN, for instance, is a sovereign, and that would be based on the idea that as James was speaking of, was the idea of respecting the norm, which are consensus, a result to the consensus of the community. So in that sense, some people might say that ICANN will be sort of a sovereign institution.
So you don't agree with that? Or do you
Well, no, I think it's actually dangerous to speak in terms of sovereignty in a sense, because it's almost a knee-jerk sort of reaction to discuss to this concept that there should be no regulation. And so to that extent, that's sort of why I